Hi, my name is Ava Langridge, and I'm here to help you become a climate activist. On this episode of Let's Talk Climate, we have guest speaker Whitney Bauck. She is an independent climate journalist focused on bringing different perspectives into climate stories and conversations. Today, we're going to cover the intersection of culture and climate, Whitney's love for mushrooms, the importance of telling climate stories, and how to make meaning in the climate crisis. Hi, Whitney. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you please start by briefly introducing yourself?
Yes, I am Whitney Bauck. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a freelance reporter who writes about climate and the environment for publications like the New York Times, the Financial Times, Washington Post, The Guardian. I'm also a climate solutions fellow at the Solutions Journalism Network.
Well, it's so lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast to talk about what you do. So tell us, how did your passion for the natural world begin?
Yeah, it's a great question. I grew up in the Philippines. So I spent a lot of time outside growing up just because it was warm all the time. So it was very easy to sort of be outside. And Philippines is just... it's just beautiful. I mean, it's like in the tropics, it's very lush sort of plant life. It's also a nation of more than 7,000 islands. So, you know, I lived in Manila, which is not on the beach, but we would go to the beach at least, you know, like once a year. So I feel like I just grew up spending a fair bit of time outside, and not in like a rural way. Like I had a very urban upbringing in a lot of ways. Like I thought of myself as a city kid growing up for sure. Which I think people sometimes see as being sort of separate from a relationship with nature, so to speak. But I actually feel like in many ways, you know, that's how more and more of us are living. More and more people live in cities than ever before. And getting to sort of have a city upbringing where I was also spending a lot of time outside, spending a lot of time, like, you know, going on really long walks in my neighborhood and looking at the sunset and, you know, seeing the creatures that run around. The lizards that live in your house in the Philippines, was just a really great way to sort of be connected with a place that I really loved, and to sort of, yeah, just to sort of like build a connection with the land and the water and the sky there.
So mushrooms, what do they mean to you?
Mushrooms. It's funny. I feel like mushrooms are really reaching a saturation point in pop culture at this point, which is relatively recent. My interest in mushrooms, gosh, I feel like it first started when I first started reporting on like ag and soil. I was writing about regenerative agriculture in the context of the fashion and textile industry in, I don't know if this would have been 2018 or 2019. And I was learning a lot about like soil health and soil structure, and like really nerding out about that and sort of the ways it's connected to life and well-being and all of these other things, and even climate. And I remember sort of coming across things sort of offhandedly talking about the role that fungi play in sort of healthy soils. I think that was sort of my first like, I don't really think about fungi that much. Like I think about plants and we think about animals. We might think about minerals like rocks and stuff, but we don't think about fungi that much. And so it sort of started from there. And then I started like, you know, reading different things, watching different things. I know a lot of people have watched the documentary Fantastic Fungi. That was definitely part of my journey of being interested in fungi. And, you know, got to do a story with Merlin Sheldrake, who wrote a book called Entangled Life a few years back, who he's a biologist, but has written a ton about fungi and mushrooms and sort of how they move through the world. And that was also really inspiring. I know there's a lot of sort of ways in for people and thinking about mushrooms and fungi. And for me, it was really like, it was intellectual. It wasn't that I like started as a forager or was tripping or whatever. Like it was really like reading about things. But the more I've learned about them, the more I think they're just a really fascinating, understudied sort of part of life. I mean, we have more genetically in common with... mushrooms have more genetically in common with us than they do with plants, even though people often think of them as like, oh, they're sort of like plants. It's like, they're sort of like animals. They can solve mazes. They have this like really bizarre sort of complex intelligence. And I think also they can sort of, you know, It's easy to anthropomorphize other living things in a way that can be helpful and can be unhelpful. So I don't think it's helpful to like frame mushrooms as like, oh, they're the hero of the story. Like mushrooms, fungi can be destructive, fungi can be constructive. But I do think that sort of symbolically, they're kind of really interesting to a lot of people because they feel like, you know, they're always breaking down death and like decay and turning that back into new life, in a way that I think can be very inspiring for humans. So I just think they're sort of a fascinating class of organisms that I think for good reason, like inspire a lot of whimsy in people. And it's just in the same way, like we wear floral prints and have been for like centuries at this point. Like I think people are starting to like want to build a relationship with mushrooms in a way that we've had relationships with flowers. Like it's expected to you like bring someone flowers as a sign of affection. We just haven't had that kind of relationship with something like mushrooms. And it's interesting to be like, what if we did? Like, what if we understood these organisms better?
Yeah, I mean, is the next step bringing mushrooms as a gift into
I would love that personally.
to...
I have become like known in my circles for my obsession with mushrooms to the point that people do like bring me mushroom stuff now. Like my aunt, I should have worn my mushroom earrings today. My aunt like bought me mushroom earrings. I had someone buy me one of those like grow kits. So I'm like very honored that when people are out in public and they see a mushroom, they like want to send a picture of it to me. So I would love a mushroom bouquet if just putting that
Yeah.
out there for anyone.
We should make a gifting mushrooms a trend. That would be a cool
Yeah,
one to make.
I'm
So
into it.
shifting just a little bit, the term intersectionality was coined in 1989 by Kimberly Crenshaw, and it is defined as a metaphor for understanding the ways that multiple forms of inequality or disadvantage sometimes compound themselves, and create obstacles that often are not understood among conventional ways of thinking. So the term intersectional environmentalism was a concept that was created by Leah Thomas, and it's crucial in understanding all dimensions of the environmental movement. Within it, there are many topics that intersect. How do you think climate and culture intersect?
It's interesting to sort of start that framing with thinking about intersectionality more broadly, because I think, you know, often when we're thinking about intersectionality in that context, we're thinking about justice and sort of the different ways that justice and injustice and different like forms of oppression, different forms of privilege sort of like lay on top of one another. And when we're talking about sort of the intersection of climate and culture, it's interesting to sort of think about how those things sort of play with one another. I think when I'm thinking about climate and culture, I'm often just thinking about like how does culture shape our climate future and our climate narrative? There can be this sort of expectation that like the real stuff, like the stuff that really matters, is basically like politics and maybe like energy. In terms of like what really has an impact on climate. And to some degree that's true, right? Like Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr., who is a another sort of legend in environmental justice spaces and has been, you know, at the forefront of a lot of this climate activism in the US for a long time, he said to me one time, you either shape policy or policy shapes you. And that's absolutely true. Like there's no sort of being apolitical isn't like a real option. Like if you're not paying attention, it's still having an impact on your life. And you know, obviously the most sort of straightforward, like what is impacting what's happening with the climate is like what is happening with our energy systems, right? Like if we burn fossil fuels, we cause greenhouse gases to, you know, there's a sort of very like there's a physics level impact. But I think why I'm so interested in culture and how it fits into all of that is it's like, how does culture dictate what is possible politically, or how does culture impact, you know, what our energy system looks like? There are a lot of reasons these things come to be, right? Like it's not new. Renewable energy is not new. And renewable energy being sort of accessible and even cheap is not necessarily new. There are reasons why fossil fuels have been like the cheaper option for such a long time, or there are reasons why certain policies get passed or certain policies don't get passed, right? Like I was wrote a story on Sunrise Movement, which is a climate activist group here in the USA, and they're, you know, Varshini Prakash, who is one of the founders, was talking about she sees one of their sort of jobs as changing what is politically possible. I think culture and its connections to climate are really interesting in that they help us understand like how human societies create the kinds of conditions that have created the climate crisis in the first place. And that's a lot of what I'm interested in. It's like, how do we move culture such that when a politician presents something like the Green New Deal, there's support for it or there's not support for it, right? Or to use a very like pertinent example right now, there's been this sort of debate exploding in the US right now around gas stoves, because the evidence that gas stoves are really harmful to human health as well as to the climate has been like, that evidence has been accumulating for a long time, such that there was a point where a government official relatively recently was like, maybe we need to look into banning these. And then suddenly this like culture war exploded of people being like, you can't take my gas stove away. Like, you can't tell me how to cook, you know, cook dinner for my own family in my own home. And that becomes culture, right? And you could say that's culture being used by the fossil fuel lobby or by, you know, sort of right wing politicians who have a lot to benefit to gain from a certain, you know, business doing well. But the tools that they're using are culture, right? Like they're saying like, you're not going to be able to cook the kind of food that you like if you don't have access to gas. And then there's this whole other group of people saying, no, you can do all of that in induction stoves. Like induction stoves are what all the pro chefs use anyway, because it's better. So it becomes this question of like, what role does culture actually play? I'm neither interested in acting like culture is the only thing that matters. Like all that matters is what we see on TV or what we hear in music or what we, you know, sort of what the zeitgeist is. But I'm also not interested in acting like that stuff is all a distraction and the real stuff that matters is like the politics or something. I think those things are deeply interconnected in a way that's worth trying to understand. And that's one of the things that I like trying to do in my work.
Do you see the potential for positive change in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's a lot of different ways to define culture too. And, you know, figuring out sort of where you draw the lines around what culture, what is culture and what isn't, that's a whole sort of other discussion. But I think some of what I come back to as some of my, like when I think about the sort of cultural forces, I think a lot about creative people and about art and music and film and literature. And I think about sort of the artist as the eye of society. I think another artist put it to me that this way at one point, like the artist is the eye of society. If they can see clearly, they can help the rest of us see clearly. And if they're not seeing clearly, they're going to steer us wrong. They're going to steer sort of like the body of society wrong. And I think that I like my sort of plea to culture makers of whatever kind, artists or rabbis or pastors or, you know, community organizers, like whoever is sort of connecting with other people in this sort of grassroots way, is to like be brave in leading around climate specifically. I think about this a lot with artists because I think there's been this like, oh, I want to stay in my lane, or I don't, you know, or I don't really feel like I can have an impact on that. Or when people are thinking about the impact they can have, they're like not being that thoughtful. I've had conversations with musicians and visual artists and, you know, filmmakers in ways that has really surprised me at some of the things that people say in terms of the sense of powerlessness that they have themselves. Like I'll talk to someone who has millions of followers online and has won all the fancy awards and whatever. And you'll ask them, you know, if they care about climate, and they'll say like deeply, this is something I think about all the time. This really matters to me. And then you look at their work and it's nowhere in their work. And I think that's where I'm like, I want to ask culture makers to say like, be brave, like be willing to try. You don't know what kind of impact that you have. If these sort of big figures in culture didn't have any impact on culture and on the outcomes of like what happens, big companies wouldn't pay them to advertise their stuff, right? Like there's these people do have a kind of influence, even if they feel like, well, you know, how does me writing a song about climate change do anything? Maybe it doesn't in a really tangible way. But I do think there's a sort of like creative and thought leadership that more, I want to see more cultural leaders like engaging with really deeply and being like brave and bold about sort of embracing.
It also kind of ties into this idea that everybody has a role to play in the climate movement, regardless of what you do. And I mean, who you are, everyone has a space and it doesn't need to all look the same. You can be an artist totally. And you can create music that is going to inspire people to take action. Or you can be a public speaker and have these conversations and share climate stories. You've told many climate stories. That include Sky High Farm, the Sunrise Movement, Linda Greer, garment workers, and many, many more. Why is it important that we share these climate stories?
There's a lot of different sort of approaches to storytelling, or people who call themselves storytellers, right? And like, you know, that could be a person who's writing narrative film, that could be a journalist. I think I'll talk specifically about journalism because that's what I do. And that is a sort of a specific kind of story. And I think part of why I really believe in the importance of like reporting on climate from a journalistic lens is that I think it is really important. I think like knowing the truth of what's happening, you can't address the thing until you know the truth of what's happening. And there's so many different sort of players out there who have an angle on like why they want to tell you a thing, right? So like a corporation will have someone on their team who's a storyteller, quote unquote storyteller, who's going to educate people, quote unquote educate people about some aspect of the climate crisis, right? But when a company does that, like they're doing that because there's some way that they think they stand to make money. They're not educating people as a public service, right? So when a corporation controls the narrative, they're gonna bend the narrative such that it benefits their bottom line. This is something that I've like observed very closely in the fashion industry, which is an industry that I reported from and on for a long time, that there would be all of these companies that would say like, we really care about sustainability. You know, we want to do this sort of education work. And education to them means helping customers understand things in a way that is going to benefit the company's bottom line. That's just one example, right? There could be a politician version of this. There could be, you know, whatever. Think of any sort of powerful entity and they're going to have a reason for the way that they're telling stories. The idea behind journalism, obviously journalism can be used to ill purpose like anything, but the idea is that it's a way of having a sort of entity that doesn't stand to gain from you understanding the story necessarily in a certain way, but it just believes that this like, you having access to the information is worthwhile. Like in some ways there is a connection to education. And you, when you think about like, I want to make sure that there's really good and deep sourcing, that I'm talking to the most appropriate expert, and that I'm getting that information in front of people. And, you know, there's sort of a lot of different things they can do with that. Right. But I think a lot about trying to help people engage with what's actually happening in terms of climate crisis, but in a way that doesn't necessarily shut them down, which is I think what a lot of climate news can do, right? Like it can be really scary, it can be really depressing. And those are true things. Like it is scary and it is depressing and it is really intense. But I think there are ways to talk about what's happening and to sort of engage with what's happening around us in ways that don't just shut us down. And that's one of the reasons that I've, you know, really enjoyed being involved with Solutions Journalism Network. Just to sort of have an emphasis on solutions. And that's not to say like solutions are the only thing worth highlighting, or that it's not worth also just telling like the hard stories. But I think my hope is to help people engage with climate in a way that allows them to be informed and connected to reality and what's happening in the world around them and not live in denial, but also that doesn't shut them down and doesn't like depress them so much that they feel like they can't actually stay engaged.
What are the ways to share and talk about the climate crisis in a way that doesn't just create eco anxiety?
There's some really good resources out there about this. There's actually in Jen Dredd, which is a newsletter by Britt Ray. She's done a lot of research on sort of climate anxiety and the mental health implications. She just did an interview with maybe a psychologist, I can't remember what his actual background was, but sort of talking about this. Because it is like, how do you talk about a really dire subject in a way that's honest without totally shutting people down? Versus, and also, like, you know, what degree of responsibility do you take for that? I think in sort of more traditional, like, newspaper journalism, which is, you know, where I spend a fair bit of time, like, I do report for a number of these kinds of newspapers. There has been a sort of attitude amongst a lot of journalists that's basically like, well, our job is just to tell the truth. And if people feel stressed about that or get shut down or whatever, like, that's not our responsibility. And there's part of me that totally understands that. And there's another part of me that's like, if my career is just creating an ecosystem that totally, like a sort of media ecosystem that just totally shuts people down, I don't want to do it. Like, my goal is not to have the impact on people that they just disengage, especially when I'm, you know, writing in the US for a lot of like Global North publications. Like, people in the Global North who have a disproportionate sort of climate impact just by existing, by the way we've set up our systems here, like, we need to be able to stay engaged because we have this disproportionate impact on the world, and we're not having to deal with the repercussions in the way that a lot of our, you know, brothers and sisters and siblings in the Global South are. So I think it's important to stay engaged, and I want to do the kind of work that allows people to do that. I think some of how I think about that is like focusing on solutions when possible. I also had a friend tell me that she felt like part of why she didn't shut down reading my stories as opposed to others was like something about having a clear moral voice, which I am still sort of like trying to think through and think about what that means. Because, you know, I'm reporting, I'm not like saying my opinions. I'm usually going and finding experts who know more about the thing and telling you what they think about it and what their research says. But I guess to the sort of question around eco-anxiety, there's got to be this balance between staying engaged and sort of recognizing responsibility towards that, and also giving oneself enough space to sort of back away when needed. And I think a lot of how that happens is like by surrounding yourself with community. Like, it's really not a question that can be answered as one individual person, but something that needs to happen in community with other people. You know, I've heard people just sort of describe it as like a choir. When you have a whole choir singing, if one person needs to like stop in the middle of a line to take a breath, it's okay. It's not like a soloist. If they stop in the middle to take a breath, it ruins the whole experience. And so the goal is to recognize like you're part of a choir. When you need to take a breath, you take a breath. And the goal is to come, you know, to come back in when you've sort of gotten that. But recognizing that like we kind of all have to hold this together for each other.
Yeah, that's a really pretty metaphor, one I haven't heard, but we'll definitely be using. So you say that a lot of your writing comes back to trying to parse human attempts at meaning making, whether via religion or art or food or clothes, especially in these times of climate chaos. What do you mean by meaning making of the climate crisis?
I think that is me trying to draw a through line through work that probably from the outside looks like it's, you know, just like ranges all over the place. I mean, I reported about religion early on in my career. I reported a lot on fashion. Now I'm primarily focused on climate and the environment. And I think a lot of what, and even sort of talking about culture, a lot of what that comes back to is I am really interested in this like human project of trying to make meaning out of, you know, what's happening in the world around us. And that's why I think I'm uninterested in things that, even if they're like, it's a big deal and it's shaping the world in some way, if it feels like it's just about a power grab, or sort of like those kinds of dynamics between human beings, I'm less interested in that than I am interested in yeah, like how we try to make meaning out of the world around us. And I think art is a way of looking at that. I think religion is a way of looking at that. I think fashion can be a way of looking at that. I think organizing can be a way of looking at that. I think grassroots politics, like, I think there are so many different ways that we sort of try to make meaning in our lives and in the world around us. And I think the ways that we do that in the face of this really existential crisis that is climate change is particularly fascinating because we're being faced with this huge, huge, huge challenge. But, you know, as we know from being people who didn't, you know, weren't alive when World War II was happening, but have probably heard so many different stories about it and seen movies and read books, and that way that narrative has been so pervasive, it's like people are really good at making meaning, actually, in the face of like really horrific and painful things. And so I think, you know, sort of trying to pay attention to how we're doing that in this era of climate crisis is, it's partly just a really interesting sort of thing to do. And I also think it gives you sort of insights into these really beautiful moments of how humans are sort of grappling with this thing that I'm grateful to like get a little window into through the work I do.
And what would be some advice you could offer to someone trying to make sense of the climate crisis?
I am very motivated by challenge. So this is not necessarily going to be relevant for everybody. But I think for me, seeing a big challenge is like, it's a big opportunity to see like, what can I step up to? And, you know, how can I sort of meet the moment? And I think if you can see it that way, I mean, it's like we have this opportunity to be part of the generation that like turns the tide on this, right? Like, I think as someone who was lucky to have like a happy childhood in a lot of ways, like I would read books of people who lived through these epic things and be like, you know, I want the opportunity to be great, which like sounds like there's so much hubris in that, right? Like, you know, whatever, grace for my younger self. But I guess it's that same thing of like with a really great challenge comes an opportunity to like step up to it and to meet the moment. And I think there's a, like, what could be more meaningful than that? What could be more meaningful than being like, yeah, I want to be part of the generation that helps shift this, that prevents as much suffering as possible, that like fights for the things that we love. I think there's a, if you can find your way to sort of, even if it's small, whatever it is, to sort of plug into this moment and to like find your place in the movement, it can be a very inspiring and like powerful and connecting force that helps connect you with the earth and helps connect you with other people in a way that I think can be really meaningful and really beautiful.
And I mean, for those trying to find their space in the climate movement as climate journalists, so that they don't make the same mistakes, what are some of the biggest mistakes you have seen other climate journalists make, and how would you recommend they would do it differently?
Honestly, I'm like, the community of journalists focused on climate are like, a lot of them are really rad people. I have a lot of respect for this community and for the people doing this work. I guess maybe some of the biggest pitfalls I would say to keep an eye out for is, especially for like white people based in the global north, is just to like keep intersectionality in mind, like you were talking about. There's been, especially in the US, there's been a history of treating the climate and environmental movements sort of being framed as like white people problems, which is just like factually not true. People of color are more impacted by the climate crisis. They're more impacted by the health impacts of pollution. They're more likely to be living near, you know, a polluting industry. And they're also literally more worried about it. Like, if you look at the polls, like Black and Brown and Indigenous people are more likely to care about climate than white people. And so the fact that we still, when we like write stories about this issue, that it so often still centers whiteness and centers the US also, I think is really worth avoiding. I think that the sort of America centrism of American media is, I mean, this isn't necessarily just a climate journalist problem, but it's an American media problem. It's, I don't know if it's, you know, like what level it's, you could argue it's American readers aren't that interested in the rest of the world. You could argue that editors aren't that willing to take stories. You could argue that the journalists aren't pitching the stories, but whatever the sort of source is, chicken, egg, whatever, we focus a lot on the US, and we don't sort of talk about or focus on the places in the world that are like really, really living on the front lines of the climate crisis, except sort of as like a one-off thing here and there. And that's something that I would love to see change. I would love for the US as a nation to do a better job of just like recognizing that the border of the US, which is relatively arbitrary and recent in human history anyway, is not like the world exists beyond that. It's not like you just fall off a cliff and then there's nothing there. And based on the way that we write about the world, you wouldn't know that necessarily. So I would love to see more focus on people living on the front lines, both beyond the US and within the US.
And using the opportunity to use your voice to kind of advocate for these marginalized communities that are primarily facing the injustices of the climate crisis. In an Instagram caption, you said that humans are not a virus. What the planet needs to heal is not for us to disappear, but for us to learn to live well here. You ended that quote by saying, "You belong here too." While you say that everyone deserves a space on Earth, do you believe that everyone needs to be involved in the fight against the climate crisis? What does that look like to you?
I think like any sort of broad, when you get this broad and you're talking about an issue that involves justice, I'm like, yes, it's everybody's job. That doesn't mean it's ever going to be everybody's career. That doesn't mean it's going to be, sort of what everybody spends all their time doing. But I think there really is a way for almost anyone to find a way to integrate climate into their work. You can be an elementary music teacher. You can be a banker. You can be a journalist. You can be a doctor. Like there is some way to integrate climate work with whatever it is that you are already doing or that you already want to do. And this is where I feel like it's a little bit like when we think about racial justice, right? It's like it's not everybody's job to go work for the NAACP. But it is everybody's job to like figure out how to move towards racial justice in their own life and their own community. And I feel like it's sort of a similar thing with climate. Like it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be your full-time job, although we probably need more people doing that. We need more people full-time working on, figuring out what, how to make racial justice part of our system. We need more people to any like name your issue. We need more people doing it full-time. But we also need people who are going to be garbage collectors and, figuring out how to integrate justice and to do things in a way that is like in line with planetary boundaries. Like that's something you can do if you work in the sanitation department. Like you can figure out what it means to do that in sort of any field. I have not yet come across a field where I'm like, I can't see any climate implications or like any ways that this connects. I think sometimes it's even, it's on a very like relational level. Like if you're building the kinds of relational networks that make for a resilient community, like that's so much of what makes the difference between whether or not a community survives and thrives in climate disaster or is like totally shut down. And we see that over and over, in terms of like when disasters sort of crop up, that the ways that we build relationships with other people really matter. So I think there's ways to sort of do things professionally. I think there's also ways to do things on a sort of personal level that's not just about like, are you recycling or composting? It's about like, how are you living in your neighborhood, in your community? And these are things that I'm still, very much trying to figure out myself. Like I don't feel like I'm nailing it. I don't feel like I'm embodying all of the values that I want to. But I think that's kind of the work for any of us, right? It's like, how do I move towards this in whatever ways I can in greater and greater ways over time?
Now let these words and this question and concept sit with you a little bit. Thank you so much, Whitney, for having these conversations. I really appreciated you joining us today and have definitely learned a lot myself.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. My name is Ava Langridge, and I'm going to help you genuinely have an impact. I'll see you again next Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific time. Bye.